Welcome to the Community Living Show on the National Campus and Radio Association Networks. My name's Kelly Rayburn. I'm going to be doing the Autism Live now because Michael was stuck on traffic and we were supposed to do an interview with Paul Gilbert, so we're going to have to leave it until next week. So here we go with the Autism Live, and I'll be back in a moment, in just a moment, to give you some of the details and stuff. You are tuned into the Community Living Show on the National Campus and Radio Association Networks. The next voice you will hear is Shannon Pemrod of Autism Live.
The advice and opinions expressed by the host of Autism Live and her guests are meant solely as suggestion and should not be in any way construed as child-specific advice. The Center for Autism and Related Disorders advises working with a board-certified behavior analyst who has experience with autism before starting any intensive behavioral intervention. Any choices you make in determining your child's treatment are completely at your own discretion.
Good morning and welcome to Autism Live. I'm Shannon Pemrod. We're coming to you live from the Warner Center in Woodland Hills, California. This is the home for the Center for Autism. It is also the home for Autism Live. We are going to be with you live for the next 2 hours talking about some pretty amazing topics. I always try to bring you great guests. I've got great guests this morning. So in fact, we've got so much programming that I got to squish the beginning here a little bit. So want to remind you, lots of experts on the show. I'm not one of them, but it doesn't mean that I don't care passionately, and I want to help you to get to the resources that you want. Samantha's going to show you some of the different ways that you can connect with us here on the show. We are fully interactive. We're on YouTube. We were a little bit broken on Roku for a while, but we're back on Roku. So check that out. We're on Periscope, Twitter, of course on iTunes, and you can get that podcast and choose whether you want to watch it or whether you just want to listen to it. And we are always on our homepage. If you go to autism-live.com, we are getting a retool on the website. It's coming very quickly. But for the moment, if you click on the triangle on the computer screen, it starts the show playing, whether it's the live or the most recent recorded version, right? And to the side of all that, there is a series of white boxes. If you put your cursor in the box, it says your question, your comment. You can talk to us and have complete and total anonymity. And it's totally free, by the way, everywhere that we are. So having said all of that, we like to start Thursday mornings with something that I fondly refer to as the jargon of the day. You know I love this, because we take one word, one phrase, one acronym, and we break it all down. We give you the actual definition, we make fun of that, and then we give you the working definition so we can begin to figure out what the heck do these things mean and why is it important to learn them. So, beginning of the year, we go back to basics, right? And so this is a word that we throw around a lot. We want to make sure you guys know what it means in relation to autism. So here we go. I'm always on the wrong side. My Carol Merrill is wrong. There we go. Antecedent. There it is. Da-da-da-da-da. What does that mean? Okay, so our actual definition, and again, this is in regards to autism and ABA. Antecedent is anything that occurs or is present immediately before the behavior of interest. All right, there's not much to make fun of there, but it's a little dry. Let's make it a little bit more accessible. Our working definition, an antecedent is what happened before. And this is really getting down to basics, that this needs to become a part of your everyday living. Not just jargon. So you go to pick up your child at school and they say, we had a rough time in English today. This should be the first thing out of your mouth. What happened before? What happened directly before whatever happened, right? Start asking these questions and you'll find that sometimes it's very elucidating. Other times you're like, okay, well, because a lot of times people will say, well, nothing happened before. That's not true. That means they weren't keyed into whatever happened. And look, we can't have eyes on everything all the time, right? And sometimes we will miss something, but there's always something that happened before the behavior. I know when you're new to the autism community, it just looks like random behavior that happens out of nowhere. Somebody wrote to us the other day and said, what do you do about a kid who is like a coin flipper? And I thought, the first part of the sentence, I thought, oh, they flip coins all the time. And they said, one minute they're happy and the next minute they're upset and that it seems unattached to anything. It isn't, though. It may be that we can't see what it is because it might be something that's happening on the inside, right? But something changed and we have to kind of become Sherlock Holmes to figure out what it is. The thing about antecedent is once you start to understand, okay, something happened before and you start to look for it, you get empowered because you can take control over that. So often we don't have control over the behavior. Once somebody is in a behavior, it's really hard. And the larger they are, the harder it is to get control of it in the moment. But we will talk about antecedent strategies to head off meltdowns, tantrums, antecedent strategies to get somebody set up for success. Oh my gosh, if we can change what happens the moment before, sometimes we only get behavior that isn't a problem. Woo, how powerful is that? So antecedent, it's what happened before. And even if you don't remember the word antecedent, just start putting it into your everyday living. Just whenever something happens, go, what happened before? Just practice it on good behavior. What happened before? Practice it on nothing behavior that's neither good nor bad, right? And figure out what happened right before that. Oh, something always happens. It's going to blow your mind when you realize it. Okay, moving on. We always have a question of the day. And our question, talking about antecedents, is what's the first thing you do every day? What's the very first thing you do? Now, some people I know open their eyes and they bound out of bed and they're like, right? Ready to go. This is not me. I don't know about you guys, but the older I get, the slower I am to get up. But I'm thinking in the morning, and you know what they say about what you think becomes what you say, becomes what you do, becomes what you are. So, you know, I have to take responsibility for because if I lay in bed and I go, oh, I gotta do that today, right? That sets me up for not success. That sets me up to trudge through my day. And I can take responsibility for that and say, you know, what do I want to be thinking in the morning? But my question is for you, what do you do first thing every day? I have a friend who, you know, gets up and makes herself a tea and sits and reads the LA Times in her backyard with all of her animals and her lovely, that sounds lovely to me. That's not my life, right? And I got to get a teenager up and out the door. But we all can make decisions about what we'd want to be the first thing of the day and does it set us up for success. So write into me. Let me know what you do first thing every day. I lay in bed and think. Okay, so then we always have a topic of the week, and I love this topic this week because it's all about fresh starts. You know, I used to be, first I was a college professor, and then for a while after 9/11, I was a classroom teacher teaching junior high and high school. And somebody said something to me once that sticks with me. Out of all the things that everybody ever said about being a teacher and how to be a good teacher, one of the things that I remember the most was, no matter what went on last week, every week there's a Monday, and it's a new start. And you can say, it's Monday, and so we're going to do it a different way. It's Monday, and, you know, here are the new rules. It's Monday, and here are the new objectives. It's Monday, and here's the new mission. It's the beginning of the year, and a lot of times we attach a lot to that and say, it's a fresh start. Well, the truth is that every Monday can be a fresh start. If you've been doing something that isn't working, you can start over. And it doesn't even have to be on Monday. You know, we can institute fresh start Thursday or fresh start Friday or new beginning Saturday, right? It can be whenever you want. I am a victim of sometimes I just get so driven of, oh, we're going to do it and we're going to do it this way because I think that's the way to do it. And I am that fly that hits itself against the screen and never realizes, oh, if you turn around, there's a whole place you can fly. So I don't know if you're like that too, but every once in a while it's good to go, wait a minute, am I beating my head on the screen? Do I need to like stop, look around and take a new fresh look at this? It can be really, really exciting. And especially where autism is concerned, because there's so many avenues you can go. If what you're doing isn't working, you don't necessarily have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but you can institute fresh start today. I give you permission. In case you needed it. If you didn't need it, it's okay. Do what you will. Move about the cabin. But fresh start, we can all do it. Okay, Speaking of that, our guests today, I'm very excited about this. First up, we have Dr. Matthew Lerner, who's going to be joining us from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. So excited to have him on the show. He's going to be talking with us about that study that we mentioned yesterday, where they're spending $2.99 million, just under three, on three different campuses to study the SENSE program. So Dr. Lerner is the lead investigator at one of the three sites at Stony Brook. He's going to talk about how the very interesting route that he took to get to this point. I think you're going to love it. And then we have Bonnie Yates is going to be here, and hopefully she's going to answer one of the questions that we had yesterday. Plus, we're going to continue on talking about the topics we were talking about last week. And then we're going to round out the show with a very special guest, first time on the show, Lee Grossman. What a history he has had in the field of autism, and used to be the president of the Autism Society of America. And wait till you hear what he's doing now. And you know, we always love to talk to an autism dad and get their perspective, but this is an autism dad who's been in this for a while, and to get his perspective on the things that he's concerned about in the autism community and where he sees the autism community going in the future. So I think you're going to love this show. We're going to take a quick break, and then we've got to get right to Dr. Matthew Lerner. Stick with us.
You're tuned into the Autism Live website on Facebook here on the Community Living Show. Please visit www.autism-live.com for all up-to-date on autism. Stay with us. We will be back more with the Community Living Show. And now, a 3-minute segment with Michael Ruben Cloggs.
The title of today's video is Don't Complain to Me. And the reason why it's called that is complaining, there's a few problems with complaining. One, it takes us from our mindset from a state of gratitude into a state of lack, meaning that we don't have what we want, and we're telling the universe to give us more of what we don't want instead of what we do want. When we stay in a state of gratitude, we actually find success, we find joy, we find happiness, we find all those things that we are looking for and that we're craving, with better relationships and just a whole lot more of things that we love and enjoy. Imagine your life filled with happiness and peace, love, trust, all those things that we just love to have around us. When we fill our lives full of lack, and we complain about things, we never seem to have enough of what we want. We always feel empty. We never feel whole. We never feel completed. So we always want to try to keep ourselves in a state of gratitude so that we feel wonderful about just being alive. So don't complain to me. And when you stop complaining and you find a state of gratitude, you'll be surprised at the amazing things that happen and the amazing things that you just experience. You find all this beauty that is out there in the universe, and you find very little of the things that you think you are missing. I will talk to everyone later, and bye for now.
The Global Accessibility Awareness Day is on the third Thursday of May of each year. The community and campus stations across Canada are hosting exclusive radio about accessibility, self-advocacy, adaptive technology, and more. For more information, contact your local stations about the National Access Day.
Welcome back to Autism Live. If you watch this show at all, you know that I love whenever we can supercharge our kids' social skills, and you know that I love theater. And our next guest is going to talk about how we're putting those two things together to make amazing things possible, and some research that they're doing to show how amazing it is. So we want to welcome to the show for the first time, but I hope not the last time, Dr. Matthew Lerner. He's joining us he's an assistant professor at Stony Brook, State University of New York at Stony Brook. So Dr. Lerner, I'm all a Twitter. I'm so excited to have an opportunity to talk to you about this, because it's two of the things that I love most we're talking about theater, and we're talking about social skills. But before we talk about that, I want to talk specifically about you and your interest as a clinical psychologist in this whole idea of social skills and supercharging them, because you've got a very special place in Stony Brook where you're working on these kinds of things. So first of all, welcome, and tell us why this is your interest and what it is that you're doing in your place that they call the Learner Lab.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anna. It's really a pleasure to be here and to have a chance to speak to you and your audience about some of the stuff that we've been doing around here. This is, you know, near and dear to my heart and my life's work. So I've been interested in sort of this topic for more than 20 years, actually, in one form or another. I kind of got into this, actually, originally, even before that, after college. I had been working, sort of volunteering for a while with a young man at the time, since he was two, actually, with autism, and I graduated from college, actually, having studied philosophy and music, and of course, as a philosophy and music major, not having a lot of marketable skills to speak of, but I was interested in autism. I had worked with one, and so I started working in social skills programs. And I was really excited to have the chance to do this because I was I wanted to sort of see what the experts did. What do the experts know? And I remember working in my first group with a group of teens on the spectrum, and my job was to sit them in a room and tell them rules for the summer. That was the main thrust of the approach that was being used. And what really struck me was that there were some kids who really grasped hold of this, loved this. They said, yeah, tell me more, I want to know. And then there were other kids who really didn't. They would get kind of frustrated with me. They would say, you know, don't tell me, I want to sit around spending time learning about things that I'm not good at during my summer. I want to have some time off. And so we kept trying to think of other ways to help those kids feel engaged, for things to feel meaningful to them and interesting to them. And so at the time, actually, I was living, you'll appreciate this, I was living with a couple of friends of mine who were actors. And seriously.
They're the best roommates.
Yes, they really are. They were great. Always paid the rent on time. And we were up one night having a conversation, and I was sort of telling them I was struggling to connect with some of these kids. And I was describing, they said, well, what are you trying to do? And I said, well, you know, it's tough because we're trying to help these kids to be able to not just do things that look social, but really connect, right? Find ways to understand other people's perspectives, find ways to, you know, regulate their responses so that other people will want to continue to talk to them, right, rather than walk away. Find ways to be engaging and interesting and unexpected, because that's what teenagers do, right? That's what they want to do. And one of them kind of looked at me and said, well, that's improv. I said, what do you mean? And we started talking about it. I started thinking about it. I had done a little bit of work in improv prior to that. And I remember staying up, you know, late into the night, feverishly writing down activities and games and things that we could do to try to adapt improvisation techniques and principles for these kids on the spectrum who are having a tough time. So I went in the next day, and I went and talked to my group leader, and she was kind enough. Again, I was a young kid in my 20s, and I was she was kind enough to say, sure, yeah, give it a try. And so we tried, and of course, I wasn't taking any data on efficacy or outcomes. I wasn't, you know, a scientist at this point. I just wanted to help these kids and wanted them to enjoy some of the time they were spending with me. We actually put on a little play that they wrote, and, you know, kids stopped throwing chairs at me. I can't say any other, you know, larger outcome. I'm not going to make, you know, claims that we changed their lives, but I can certainly say when we were doing these activities, kids seemed more interested and engaged. And it was really interesting, right? Because what we were doing is giving them the opportunity at least to engage on their terms and engage in the things that were interesting to them. You know, we could set up a scene, or we could set up an improv game that was based around whatever it was that they wanted to talk about, whatever they thought was interesting, rather than me saying to them, well, look, today we're talking about going to the cafeteria, and I don't, you know, it doesn't matter if you had a bad time in the cafeteria, that's what we're talking about. So, you know, that seemed to be an inroad. And what happened after that was kind of interesting. I started working in in-home early intervention for some time with kids on the spectrum. And the mother of the young man on the spectrum who I worked with for since he was 2 years old, he was a teenager at that time, she came to me and she said, you know, he's having a tough time in all the different programs in the Boston area. I was living in Boston at the time. And she said, well, what are we going to do about this? And I said, what do you mean we? I don't know. What can I do? It's working. She says, well, you know him, and you did that thing at that camp once. What if we start a camp? And I said, I don't know how to start a camp. she said, well, why don't you just take that idea and build it out? And I was fortunate to end up writing a grant, end up working with a wonderful, brilliant clinician by the name of Karen Levine, who's one of the most well-known, well-respected autism clinicians in the Boston area. And an organization then called the North Shore Arc, now called the Northeast Arc, was kind enough to sponsor us. And we created a program called Spotlight. And Spotlight was essentially this same model, but brought to scale. And I actually hired, no joke, the people in the first cohort of staff for Spotlight were special education teachers and actors, just that. And actually more actors than special education teachers. And trained them essentially in this approach of you know, how do we adapt the tools that we use to teach people theater to help kids with autism be able to find their way in the world. And we initially recruited all kids who had not had good experiences in the other programs in the Boston area, and they came to us, and again, at least they had a good experience. At the end, they all reported having a good time, nobody got kicked out, and everyone said they wanted to come back, and at the end, they made a movie. They all made a movie together that they wrote. They did the cinematography, some groups directed it, some did star in it, they did music, and a couple of plays, short plays. And that was fun. And it was actually supposed to be a one-off, but then actually a woman by the name of Luann Larson, who was my boss at the Northeast Arc, came back and said, you know, all nine of these families have come to us and said, can we do this year-round? And I said, well, sure, let's give it a try. And so the program started to grow, and we went from 9 kids to 27 kids to 71 kids in the course of about 6 months. We were embedded in school districts, more than a dozen districts around the Boston area. We were doing after-school programs, summer programs, vacation programs, in services and trainings and clinics. and it was kind of running this whole model. After doing this for a few years, I had what I call my crisis of science. And the crisis of science was basically this, that, you know, this all felt good and kids seemed to enjoy it. But the question was, what are we really doing here? Is this really helping more, the things that, you know, that we want to affect? Is this as helpful for kids' ability to socially connect, as you say, to supercharge their social skills? Is it more effective than a really good after-school program at the YMCA for $20? Because if it's not, kids should spend their time at the YMCA program for $20. and I thought, you know, but I didn't really know how to measure that, how to address that question. And I thought, you know, also there are some kids, this wasn't for everyone, some kids liked it, some kids didn't, but how can we predict that? And how can we use that information to make the program better and to hone in on the things that work the best? And then also, how can we get this information out into the world in a way that is fair, in a way that is not, that's accessible, that's right, that's not very expensive to families all over the country? And so I actually sort of left the program is still running right now, and it's doing very well up in the Boston area, but I left it for an academic research career, which, you know, led me through all the different steps and, you know, ultimately to running my lab here at Stony Brook called, some people call it the Learner Lab. And we call it the Social Competence and Treatment Lab, or SCTL. We do not have any sponsorship from SCTL at this point, SCTLs, but maybe we'll ask one day. And essentially what we're trying to do here is exactly the thing that I set forth to do when I left Spotlight, which is to try to look at all different kinds of programs, not just, you know, theater-based programs, but all different kinds of programs aimed at understanding and improving social competence, and say, do they work? How do they work? Using all different kinds of measures. We use EEG and other brain-based measures. We look at how kids are doing in school, both socially and academically. We look at parents' reports and teachers' reports. We look at how kids do in novel social settings. We hold pizza parties and let kids have these opportunities to try these things out. And we use that to try to better understand where social challenges are coming from, how kids are understanding the world, and then how to use that to better tailor what we're doing to the needs of the kids we're trying to help. So that, I don't know if you want me to pause there for a moment.
Well, you know, it's all so exciting to me because you're singing my song here. I absolutely love this. And I love that you've got a place there where not only are you doing the things that you're finding work, but you're checking to make sure that they do work. Because we need to have people like you, because the actors will run around and they'll go, well, it seems like everybody's happier and more productive. But for you to be able to say, yes, but this is what's working and this is why that it's working, helps to get funding for more programs to happen so that we can get to that equitable that you're talking about. And I love that there is more and more research that's being done on these subjects. And you are involved in something right now that's called SENSE. Tell us what that is and what you're getting ready to do.
Absolutely. So importantly, while I just told you my story, I'm far from the only person to have had the epiphany that acting training might help us learn something about how to do a better job of helping with social skills. A number of folks have had this realization. A number of women, by the name of Laura Gooley, who's down in Texas, Kelly Hunter in England, Cindy Schneider and Amelia Davies, who have written books about this. But one wonderful person, and in some ways maybe, you know, perhaps the leader of the field in this area, is a professor by the name of Blythe Corbett at Vanderbilt. She's an associate professor over there in the Department of Psychiatry. And she is a well-established autism researcher. She looks at things like cortisol and stress hormones and how those things happen, unfold in adolescence and autism. She, as I said, she works at Vanderbilt. She used to work at the UC Davis Mind Institute. But she also has had a longstanding interest in theater and has actually, you know, been an actress at various points in her career as well. Has written plays, and around the same time that I was starting Spotlight, actually, she was developing this model called SENSE. And SENSE is similar to the approach that I described in that, you know, it's about capitalizing on the techniques of theater training, but it actually even goes a step further and really focuses on every time actually, you know, creating a play. They literally will create a play from start to finish, and the end of the 10 weeks of the program, the after-school program, is a true production in the community. And it's truly community-embedded. It's a peer-mediated approach as well, so typically developing peers also are participating and are also getting the theater training experience, too, and all the benefits of that. But again, they're integrating well-established and evidence-based core principles of behavioral techniques designed to improve social challenges, along with all of the really cool benefits of being involved in theater. So Blythe has been a pioneer in studying these kinds of approaches. She's done a series of community-based trials, randomized control trials, and I'm pleased to share that we recently received a large, what's called R01, multi-million-dollar, four-year multi-site grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to study the SENSE program. here and at Vanderbilt with Dr. Rod Corbett, and at Virginia Tech with Dr. Susan White. And we're all people who have done social programming for kids on the spectrum for a long time. Susan White has done this in more cognitive behavioral-based approaches, and is now moving into the theater realm. And of course, I'm really excited to get a chance to do the SENS Theater Program. And what's really neat about it, too, is, as I said, it's not only a chance to, you know, study this rigorously in the lab. Again, we're using brain and behaviorally based measures to examine what's going on before, during, afterwards, follow up, but also to really work with our local community. So we're going to be partnering with our local school district that Stony Brook is in to host the actual events and to allow us to use their theater, and we'll work with them in the community to administer the program too. So it has this kind of great knock-on effect of not just trying to help the kids who have these challenges, but also perhaps to destigmatize autism a bit in the community, and then for folks in the area to look and say, hey, these kids are really good. These are not you know, halfway shows. These are not just shows that are there to make people look and say, oh, look at them try. They're doing real theater. And maybe improving their social competence as well.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some nuts and bolts in the program. When are you actually starting? Who is going to be involved? Like, are you putting feelers out to the community? You said you're working with a school. Will there be auditions? What's going to happen?
Yeah, great question. So it's very interesting. It's actually a true randomized trial, in that we have sense as one condition, and then we also have a different condition that kids can be in, both of which are sort of active things that we believe to help us. And what's novel here is it's not just being compared to sitting on your hands and waiting. People can come sign up. We have a number of families, several hundred families in the Long Island area of kids on the spectrum who we reach out to participate in studies. Any of them can join. There's also members of the local community, both the typically developing kids and kids on the spectrum who can participate. We are putting out feelers. We're going to be putting ads in newspapers. We're going to be advertising on the web. Essentially, we're going to say, come on in and join us. And we're hoping to be beginning enrollment over the next maybe month or two. And then beginning in, we're hoping March, April, we're going to be starting one of the two conditions. As I said, one is sense. The other one is something called Tackling Teenage, which is a approach for learning about some of the challenges of adolescence and pubertal development that happen for all teenagers. But designed really for kids on the spectrum, talking about things like dating, talking about things like how your body changes, or how do you know if somebody's interested in you, and how do you know if you're interested, and how do you respond in certain ways. This is sort of another domain of social challenge that isn't exactly what we're focusing on in SENS, but is also something we believe that many families and kids have told us they need. They don't just believe it, they've told us this. So our hope is that way we're providing a service and a benefit to everyone who enrolls, no matter what. So that process, as I said, begins over the next couple of months. We run our first set beginning in March, April, and then our second over the summer. And then we'll be running this for 4 years. So essentially families can, you know, continuously enroll, and what's great is, of course, it's free.
Oh, that's amazing. That was going to be my next question. What is the cost? Now, is there going to be a third group of teenagers that you compare that don't get these social skills with?
Yeah, it's a good question. So at the moment, there's not. And this is because, actually, as I said, Blythe has done the wonderful work leading up to this, in which she's done those studies before.
So okay.
People have published on this. She's published on this a number of times, showing compared to nothing, sense helps with kids being pro-social, kids' ability to understand and take each other's perspectives, ability to read emotions. So now what we want to understand is something more specific, is doing this sense theater program certainly seems to be better than just sitting around doing nothing. But is that special? Is it unique and specific to this kind of theater-based approach? Or you just get it because you're getting out of the house and you're doing some activity with others, which, of course, is the huge question that, again, has been on my mind for 15 years. And it's really exciting to be involved in a project with, wonderful colleagues where we actually get to start to try to answer that question.
I just think this is so smart. And I think, I'm curious to know what you think you're going to find. And I don't know whether that's an ethical question for you at this point. But I've certainly talked with Dr. Temple Grandin about what she thought helped her when she was a teenager to help her to be able to do the things that she's done. One of the first things she always cites is theater. And in talking to her mom said something that just rang so true with me, that she said, we all have to find our tribe. And if you don't have a tribe, your ability to try social things out and succeed diminishes greatly. And theater creates a tribe. We know that for sure. I don't know that taking a social class does, but I know that theater creates a tribe.
Absolutely. And we've seen that all along. And it's one of my favorite kind of knock-on effects of using this kind of approach, is because you're giving all these kids the opportunity to kind of interact in their terms and allow their quirks to be their quirks, right? Just like we let typically developing kids have their quirks be the things that allow them to connect. This can create that sense of tribe. I'll never forget the very first time I ran the Spotlight program. One of the kids in that initial group I told you about came over about halfway through and tugged on my shirt and said, "Hey, Matt." And I said, "What?" He said, "Where did you find all these kids?" And I said, "What do you mean? They're all from all around the area. Why do you ask?" And he goes, "This is the first normal group of kids I've ever met."
And
it's so powerful. And first of all, again, I think it highlights your point about, you have to find your tribe. But also, I think it's so important to use approaches that give kids and adults, frankly, on the spectrum, the opportunity to find their place in that tribe, and to see that tribe as theirs, if they want to, right? I've certainly also had kids come and say, I don't know, I don't want to do this, and it's up to each individual person. But I think creating ways that people can figure out what their place is in the world and who they feel good with, that's what it's all about. And I so resonate with your point that I suspect that theater uniquely gives us this opportunity. And actually, to your point about what do we think we're going to find, I did a smaller version of the study that we're describing now here at Stony Brook recently. Much smaller. The sense study is going to be hundreds of kids. This was about 50, and we compared my intervention, the Spotlight intervention, it's called STARI, to kind of an active group where kids were doing kind of recreational programs. And I don't want to spoil it too much, because the paper is coming out soon. But one of the things that we do find actually is exactly that over the course of that time, when we ask kids, do you want to play with each other again? Do you want to see each other again? Who in this group, you have people in this group who are your friends, people who are engaging in these, specifically in these theater-based activities, seem to be saying yes more. Teens seem to be saying yes more.
Well, I know that one of the things our audience are asking is, what's the chance that we can get something like this in our community? Is Spotlight or Sense something that you guys already have a manual that if somebody wants to take it and replicate it someplace else, is it possible? Can they get trained?
Yeah. So those are excellent questions. So what I can tell you, first of all, the good news is, there are manuals for things like this. So as I said, Dr. Laura Gooley, who's down in Austin, Texas, has a great book called The Social Competence Intervention Program, or SCIP, which is a very similar model. She actually created it for her dissertation, and frankly, I think it looks a lot like Spotlight and STARI. A woman named Sydney Schneider, a woman named Amelia Davies, both have similar books. You can buy them on Amazon. And so those... So certainly for folks who say, I want something, right? It's not that there's nothing else there. But I think this is where both Blythe and I have tried to really think carefully as scientists, which is to say that there's, as you know, if you Google social skills books in Amazon, you get 100, maybe 200 options at this point. And only a fraction of those have ever really been studied. Only a fraction of those can truly be called evidence-based. I have a number of them over here, actually. I think both of us share the goal of ensuring that, rather than having sort of more horse races and more things for people to buy and be confused about, that we want to make sure that what we're putting out is meets the highest standards of empirical science, that we are, that by the when, you know, these models are becoming more distributed, when you can finally, you know, pick up a sense manual or a Starry manual, that we can, you know, have that really crucial section in the front where we say, here's the data that suggests this will help. And I want to even go a step further and say, here's our guess about who it's most likely to help.
I love that. But if this is a four-year study, does that mean that you're not going to publish for 4 years, or are you going to have points along the way where you're going to publish?
We should have points along the way. And importantly, there have been publications along the way in the research literature about this model. The other thing I can say, too, is that, you know, there are ways to get trainings. I have colleagues who we've trained who now can go around and do these sorts of things. It's not quite formalized. It's not like one of these big network models like some other approaches have. And again, that's because we're being cautious. But certainly, we're not just going to keep our lips zipped for 4 years.
I hope not. I really hope not. That would be cruel. It's that thing of reinventing the wheel. I know that a lot of people have been doing this. We live here in Los Angeles, and we've got amazing theater groups for teenagers here. But for people that are in the middle of Idaho and have, you know, and they're saying, hey, wait a minute, what can we do here? I want to make sure that people get access to things. That's what we do here. So don't sit on it too long, Dr. Lerner, but we think that this is amazing. If people want to know more about Spotlight or Starry or Sense, where can we send them? I know that we want to send them to the Lerner Lab, which is lernerlab.com, correct?
That's right.
And people are going to drool, because you've got a lovely website there that talks about a bunch of things that you're doing, and you have more things there that are just for teenagers. I was looking at your site and going, man, why don't we have this here? You got a study right now about spousal support?
Yes, that's true. Yes, one of my students is interested in trying to understand, you know, what a parents need to be able to get the support they need to address the stresses that come along with being a parent. Very hard, and it can be hard for parents and kids on the spectrum.
It's your website is drool-worthy. For an autism parent, you look at it and you go, I'm so glad they're studying. Oh, look at that. Look what they're doing. You've got some performances listed on it. Yes?
Yeah, I think one thing that we really pride ourselves on, and it's something that I would say also, again, Blythe Corbett, who's my colleague, who I mentioned, who's leading the study, as well as Susan White at Virginia Tech. I think one of the things we all have in common is we all try to do research that is community informed and community driven. So what I mean by that is, I've been at Stony Brook for 5 years, and I spent my first 2 years here, we were collecting almost no data. We ran almost no studies. Instead, I was out in the community meeting with parents, whether it's giving a talk to a parent-teacher organization or meeting with, you know, four moms in a basement with some lemonade and cookies, and sharing them with them what we wanted to do, but also listening and saying, what do you need? Because every community is unique in terms of its needs. And so the research program we have built here, and this is also true at Virginia Tech, it's also true at Vanderbilt, is really based not just on our interests as scientists saying, we think this is cool and important, but based on what those families have told us matter so much. And I think it gets to the point of, you know, this question of theater being really unique, this program, families have been excited about it everywhere.
Yeah.
Didn't matter where we were.
Yeah.
And you know, we're really trying to respond to the need.
Well, I, you know, as I said, I appreciate you're doing the science, crossing the T, dotting the I, because that's going to make a huge difference in funding. But a lot of us already know that this is an amazing thing, that this has the ability to help, if not all, then certainly a lot of our teenagers to access social skills in a way that's really effective. So I know you're going to find out for sure, but I already know.
I think what we want to know, though, is why and how and when and for whom, all the really nuanced questions. One of my the biggest inspirations, I think, in this field is actually a colleague of mine now at George Mason University named Talia Goldstein. And she studies the effects of theater on social development and social cognition in typically developing kids. And she'll, you know, go and work with, you know, 100 four-year-olds in a low-income classroom. And, you know, she's thought more about this issue than probably anybody on the planet. And I love working with her because what she keeps saying, she's been an actress and worked in theater. We've worked with major theater organizations together. And, you know, what she said is, you know, those of us who work in this field have had that kind of intuition. But one, as scientists, we always need to check our intuitions and
yes.
See if the data support them. But also, you know, we need to be able to go further than that. And we can do with data, the sort of magic of really good science is you get to peel back the veneer of what just looks like it's so and look underneath and say, well, what's really going on? And who is really benefiting? And how does this differ over ages? And one of the things that she's shown is that she's shown benefits, for instance, of participating in theater programs for, you know, 4-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds. But the benefits are really different in each. And that has to also then be true if we're talking about kids on the spectrum. So now we can actually learn about what makes it work for each of those age ranges. And again, you know, my goal, my dream is like an evidence-based menu. Right? You can bring in your 8-year-old and say, I've got these 10 things that I've done a 20-minute assessment with your child, and I can tell you, of these 10 things, here are the 4 of them that are most likely to be helpful, and now let's work together and figure out what he wants the most and what you want.
I absolutely love it. Again, we want to tell people to go to learnerlab.com, but I do want to mention again that Stony Brook is just one of the 3 sites where this is going to be happening. So the other one is at Vanderbilt, and then the third one is at Virginia Tech. And so if you are in any of those areas, you want to be contacting folks to know how you can get your child involved. 4 years worth of studies. We love that you guys got the funding.
Great.
3 years worth of study? I thought it was...
No, 4 years worth of studies, but it's free.
Oh, free. Free. I thought you said 3. Yeah, free. Amazing. We love free, but we love effective more, and I think it's going to be both. So, again, look, there are articles right now about Sense, and we'll put some links on our website, too, and on our Facebook page so that you can find in all 3 places who to connect with to get your child started. Dr. Lerner, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for being with us. I look forward to having you back on the show to talk about what happens further down the road.
You got it. I'll come anytime. This has been great.
It's been really wonderful. Thank you so much. Stick with us, because when we go to break, I want to talk to you about something. And for all of you, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to be back with Bonnie Yates, special education attorney, after these messages. So stick with us.
You're tuned in to the Autism Live special on the Community Living Show on the National Campus and Radio Association Networks with your host, Shannon Penrod. We'll be back in a moment on the Community Living Show and, of course, the conclusion of Autism Live podcast. For more information or to pick up a free newsletter from their website, www.autism-live.com. The Community Living Show is stories for the people with disabilities, self-advocacy, adaptive technology, and many other issues, along with accessibility issues. If you want to participate and are a member of any of the NCRA radio stations, including this station that you're listening to in the area, or if you have any story idea and want to become involved in the technician personnel, please email us. Our email address is communitylivingradio@gmail.com. No experience necessary. People with disability or non-disability are welcome to the show.
Open Media International is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
Do you have any awareness of what's been happening with newspapers in the last 10 years?
Not at all. I mean, truth is, I don't even get them anymore. I just read the news on my phone.
It's so much better, and it's free.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The future of news media is in your hands. If you're interested in independent journalism and current affairs, CITR's News Collective is for you. Help hound down stories about diverse and underrepresented issues in the Lower Mainland for Democracy Watch, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. Email volunteer at citr.ca to get involved.
Welcome back to Autism Live, and we're so excited because joining us right now via Skype is Bonnie Yates, special education attorney. She's joining us courtesy of the law firm of Heerji and Chow. We adore her, and we adore Heerji and Chow. Welcome back, Bonnie. Want to give us the disclaimer and information about Heerji and Chow?
No, I'm thinking of having like a temper tantrum like a two-year-old and saying, I want to do the craft project that you were just doing instead.
Both Bonnie and I were geeking out over the craft project going, that looks like fun. I want to do that. I love that. I'm right there with you. Let's go okay. Play with some crayons.
Sometime in 2018, we will play with
crayons. Let's do it.
I have a lot more to say about that. Anyway, yes. The disclaimer is that we are going to answer your special education legal questions, and we do so relying on California law, primarily because I'm licensed in California, and secondarily because IDEA is a federal statute. It applies in all the 50 states. So in your state, if you're not in California, the same answer might be true as under California law, but it might not. So we're giving questions, you know, general answers under California and federal law. We're also telling you, you know, it's not a haste makes waste situation. If you have a particular special legal problem with regard to your child's special needs or IEP, you should consult a lawyer in your own state because they will be much better able to address your specific problem. And so that's the disclaimer.
And we love the disclaimer. But having said that, there was a question that we had yesterday during Ask Dr. Doreen. Both Dr. Doreen Grampuchet and I commented on it, but we both agreed that we would be very interested in hearing your opinion. It was from a parent. The conversation came up about a three-year-old and what they were doing with a three-year-old. And at one point, Dr. Grampuchet said, well, maybe it was a different question. They were talking about ABA in the classroom, and she was saying, make sure that your child has a full ABA program, that, you know, that they're doing things in the classroom and then you're doing things at home. And so somebody wrote in and said, how do you get an ABA program in your classroom, especially when they have told you that your child doesn't need ABA and that what the teacher is doing is enough? And that kind of set off a firestorm in my head simply because of the word choice of enough. And so we did talk a little bit about the Supreme Court case and the de minimis, because enough kind of tweaks me.
Well, I think it tweaks everybody because, you know, its interpretation will be playing out in the courts. We don't really know yet. Andrew says you have to give more than, you know, de minimis help in a given year, but it's clearly not a maximization kind of a proposition. So figuring out where the sweet spot in the middle is something that the lawyers on both sides are going to be arguing. But in the specific instance where your child needs ABA in the classroom and the district says they're doing enough, I mean, that just sends me down a complete and total rabbit hole. And I have to talk a little bit about what's happened in the last 20 years. So the Lovaas study was quite a while ago, right? It was 1987. So for all intents and purposes, it's 30 years old, which is mind-blowing. And so the Lovaas study was groundbreaking in that it introduced everybody to this notion that ABA could have a profound effect on the development of a child with autism. And when I came into sort of the autism wars, it was like 1994, because my child was four and he had just gotten diagnosed with autism. And at that time, there were really very few categorical public programs in public schools for kids with autism. And there was clearly no teacher training specific to autism. And we started going in to classrooms and asking for ABA. And we started getting ABA in discrete circumstances because the district would lose because they had no autism program. So with a lot of these things, there was, you know, kind of like, it was like the new frontier, right? Or honeymoon or whatever. And then the district started saying that, you know, no, we're not going to do this. We don't want to pay for it. And we don't believe in this notion that you have to have applied behavior analytic treatment. We don't buy that it's a state-of-the-art treatment. We have an eclectic program. It uses the best of a lot of different methods. And when you would, you know, take them to task about this, of course, they didn't have any validation studies, and they didn't really have, you know, they were looking at other programs like Teach. Teach was a big one, and then it would just sort of be like whatever they kind of made up. I mean, it was, and so then we started having all these challenges to programs on the grounds that they were eclectic, and this would have been in the 90s. And then what you saw kind of around the beginning of 2000-ish is that districts realized they were going to lose on eclectic programs.
Well, that is it for the program for today. Sorry we have to cut it short because of the hour show. But you can always tune in to our SoundCloud system for the rest of the interview. Our website is www.soundcloud.com/communityliving radio. That's all in one word. And you can check out our show from there. So on behalf of myself, Michael Ruben Cloggs, and, of course, Shannon Pamrod from Autism Live, we thank you very much for tuning in. We are on three different radio stations on the NCRA radio stations. We're hoping to get one on CHLY radio. Check local listings for shows and times for the Community Living Show. The email or the website address is www.chly.ca for all details. But anyways, we are on the rest of the radio station networks. We're also on Radio Program Exchange. Visit previous.ncra.ca for all the details on our show. We're also on Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM every Sundays from 10 to 11 a.m. Visit us www.coopradio.com or coopradio.org, I should say, not com. Coopradio.org, that is the place to be. We're also on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming online at CITR.ca. We broadcast every Tuesday afternoons from 1 to 2 p.m. If you have any questions about our show, please email us. Our email address is communityliving radio@gmail.com. Thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Kelly Reber on the controls, and we'll hope to see you again next week. And of course, next week we will have our panel, BC Disability Caucus, Paul Gilbert. Thank you very much for tuning in. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Listen, radio.